You're listening to a Cripple and Co. production.
This episode of Disability After Dark has been brought to you by Come As You Are. Come As You Are is Canada's only worker-owned co-op sex shop. Trans-owned and operated, Come As You Are carefully reviews and curates their selection of sex toys, books, and DVDs. Now you can get 15% off your next purchase at comeasyouare.com using coupon code AFTERDARK. This episode of Disability After Dark has been brought to you by clonawilly.com. ClonaWilly and ClonaPussy are do-it-yourself molding kits that allow anyone to make an exact replica of any penis or vulva into a sex toy at home. So if you go to clonawilly.com and you use the code Andrew Gerza, so just spell my whole name, at checkout you can get the ClonaWilly or ClonaPussy kit and anything else site-wide at 20% off. Wow, this is a deal that cannot be cloned. I have been in contact with my friend Victoria over there, and they're so friendly, they're so kind, they really want to make sure that if you want to create your own ClonaWilly or ClonaPussy molding kit of your own body, they want to make it accessible for you, they want to listen to your questions, they want to help you where they can. So if this is something you're interested in, please head over to ClonaWilly.com and use my promo code Andrew Gerza right now to get 20% off site-wide. Thanks again to ClonaWilly for sponsoring this episode. Content warning. The language, content, and discussion found within this episode of Disability After Dark will be explicit. Listener discretion advised.
This is a podcast that looks at disability stories. It's like sitting down with a really close friend to have a real conversation about disability, sexuality, and everything else about the disability experience that we don't talk about. The things about being disabled, we keep in the dark. Here is your deliciously disabled host, disability awareness consultant, Andrew Gerza.
Hello, hello, friends. Welcome to the show, friends, and thank you so much for clicking on this brand new episode of Disability After Dark, the podcast shining a bright light on disability stories. I'm, of course, your deliciously disabled host, Andrew Gerza. Let us get comfy, cozy, and crippled and get today started, shall we? My guest on the show today is someone that I really enjoy talking with, my friend Ryan Manriquez. He is somebody living with spinal muscular atrophy. We talk about both of us living with severe disabilities. He shares with us his experience being disabled in student government and so much more. He was such a fun guest. I really love sitting down with the younger generation of disabled folks. He is 23 and he's so poised and so knows what he wants and has a drive. And I really, really enjoyed sitting down with him. And I cannot wait to share this interview with you. So there's no banter today. There's no lead up to what we're doing. I'm just gonna give you the interview because it was so good and so fun. So without further ado, here is my friend Ryan Manriquez, right here on Disability After Dark. Ryan, hello.
Hello, Andrew. It's so good to see you again.
It's always a pleasure to see you. We were talking off the air, but did you hear how quickly I switched into radio voice? Because
I love it. Talk radio host. I love
just
that.
Boom, somebody hire me, man. You and I know each other because I did some work for you last year. I was a speaker at one of your school's events.
Very grateful.
How we connected, and then we've been friends on the IG. I mean, the hellscape that is social media today. And I wanted to have you on the show for a year and a half, and here we're doing it. So I'm excited that it's happening.
So honored to be here and just talk with you.
It'll be a good time. So I know who you are, and I know how awesome you are, but can you say hello to the people, introduce us to yourself?
Yes. Hello, everyone. My name is Ryan Manriquez. I use he, they pronouns. I am 23 years old, and I live with spinal muscular atrophy type 2. Been in a power wheelchair all of my life, power wheelchair user.
Yeah.
I love speeding through the hallways and getting constant jokes thrown at me about people writing me a ticket. No, I
How
don't.
fast does it go?
So I actually have an upgraded motor. The usual speed for a chair like mine goes 4.5 miles an hour, but I said, nah, I need a little more speed. So I have a motor that goes 7.8 miles an hour.
Whoa, you got like
Yep.
warp, that's warp speed, man.
Yep.
I mean, I was kidding when I asked that question. I was doing
Oh,
like
okay.
you know, when the guys were like, "Hey man, how fast does it go?" I don't fucking know. I'm going to my life. Leave me alone.
Well, I have an odometer on my chair, so it tells me how fast I'm going. So it's literally, I have that, and well, so that's a speedometer, odometer. Here we go. It tells me the miles, and I actually have over 1,200 miles on my chair.
What there should be like a like cripple reward points for like if you get over a certain number of miles, you get like a free trip somewhere or something.
Yeah, you should get some tokens or whatever.
Like somebody in wheelchair land needs to like Permobil. Can you not fund a card if somebody gets 100,000 miles on the wheelchair, you give them like a free trip? Like you get like.
Yeah, Permobil and Invacare are going to be listening in, but they better give you credit for that idea.
Yeah, like seriously, I know someone from Permobil is listening. If you are listening, first of all, thank you for your chairs. Secondly, make it happen and credit me. Thank you. The first question that I asked all my guests, but you kind of beat me to the punch there, is what are your disabilities and how do they impact your day to day? So I know a lot of folks with SMA. I have friends with SMA, so I know it a little bit, but it looks different on everybody. And I. Until you said you had SMA, I didn't know. So now I know. Now I do. So what, how does SMA impact your day-to-day life?
So SMA, I have spinal muscular atrophy type 2. I've been in a wheelchair all of my life. The different types, they go type 1, type 2, type 3, and type 4. Type 1 is the most severe. I have type 2, being in a wheelchair, being a wheelchair user, pretty much for the duration of your life. And then type 3, you can walk up until a certain point or have mobility up to a certain point, and then you'll probably be using a wheelchair later in your life. But types are getting thrown out. There's been so much medical innovation and pharmaceutical innovation that's been happening on SMA. We have three FDA approved treatments right now, the first ever FDA approved treatment happening in 2016.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of medical advancements in that area. But I know we're not here to talk about the medical side. I want to talk about more of the
I mean,
social and
we can talk about the medical side. How do like as somebody with SMA, how do you feel about the advancements in that?
It's a pretty cool time to be living with SMA. A lot of clinical trials that are being available. I've seen the impact firsthand, both with people older than me, people who are my age, and people who are younger than me, right? Children, adolescents who have been so positively benefited from these new
Yeah.
treatments. I think a thing that we often discuss in our community is what is the access like? What is the cost like? Because a
Yeah.
lot of these treatments, especially when you're trying to treat a rare disease, the dollar sign on that is going to be fairly high.
Yeah.
There was even a news article a couple of years ago when the second approved treatment came out. It's a one-time infusion that costs around $2.1 million just for one single dose.
Hang on, wait, and you have to put what?
So it's only available to, I would say, the younger side of people with SMA right now, but it was certainly, it's an eye popper, right? It
Yeah.
your eye in terms of just, wow, how are families going to be able to pay for this? Will insurance approve it? I think insurance approvals are very, very complex, especially when a new medication is being released in general. Now add a $2.1 million,
Price
cost
tag,
price
yeah.
tag with that, and I'm sure it gets a lot tougher. But I've seen, like I said, I've seen people benefit from a broad range of treatments, and it's just remarkable. Because SMA is a naturally progressive disease, so over time you'll get worse and worse. And
Yeah.
I know for a fact, in if I wasn't on treatment or if I didn't start treatment when I did in about 2017. I would not be where I am today, in my social life, professional life, academic life. any life. I know it's made a huge impact for me and for so many other people.
That's, you know, and I remember seeing people, friends of mine on social media who were talking about the treatments, and I remember the backlash some of them received from hearing other people say, like, well, why would you want to cure this? Why do you want to, like, remove your disability? And I remember thinking, you know what? If you don't live with this thing, you don't get to speak on it. And even if you do, you don't get to speak on their experience. If they want it, it's their right to try.
So absolutely. And I've even heard members of our community say the exact same thing. And one thing that I want to say about that is that that is 100% valid. I can completely see where you're coming from, because if you feel like you take a medication that will change your disability, right, or alter your disability to some extent, you will lose a portion of the identity in which you hold most dear. And that is something that I reconcile with every time I go in for treatment. But I know that I'm at a baseline right now, or I'm at a plateau, they'll say, right? So I know I will never walk in my life, right? Unless some really, really wild things happen. But I'm okay with that, because I like where I'm at with my disability. And it's a point that I hope others get to experience, where I feel comfortable in my body. I feel comfortable with the independence levels that I have in my day-to-day routine. And it's partially because I've had a little lift because of treatment that I'm able to accomplish that. So I still hold my disability as my primary identity, right?
Yeah.
And even though I'm on treatment, it hasn't, you know, barred me from experiencing those emotions or that identity.
I can't believe you're 23. I'm considerably older than you, and you hold yourself really well. When I was 23, I was like the party kid that didn't give a shit and wanted to just party. Like, you're so well put together. And I don't mean that in like a weird, like, look at you, good for you being the wheel. I mean, like, when I was 23, I was like, when are we going to the next party? When can I meet a boy? How do, like, what? Who cares about school? What, like, what?
Well, believe me, Andrew, I've had those phases as well, too. I think I've mellowed out now that I'm in grad school, and grad school just means you literally won't have time to go to parties and to do all of those things. But I believe me, we're not too far from that time where I was also experiencing those things and wanting to do all of those things.
And I also can imagine, like, as somebody with a progressive disability where you know it's progressive, you don't necessarily have the time to, and not to be morbid or not to be weird, but you don't have the time to, like, to not think about the other stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, living with SMA is time consuming. It takes you longer to do so many things. It takes me longer to eat, takes me longer to use the restroom, to get up in the morning. And by the time the day is up, right, and I've gone through a full day of classes, gone through a full day of advocacy meetings, I'm burnt out. By the end of the day, my body is tired. So I'm to the point where I don't know if I can go out for drinks with all of my grad student buddies. And I don't know if I can go out to that concert or that baseball game on Friday night. So it's hard being in that place still sometimes. But I think often what we do is we push ourselves, right, to do those things. Because there's the flip side of it, where I recognize I have a progressive disease, so I want to do everything now before I can't later, right?
Yeah.
So there's also that side where I want to experience as much as I can right now while I'm young, and while I have this energy and while I have this strength, because in 10 years from now, will I be even more tired than how I am right now, right?
Yeah. And I can, you know, they say that CP is not progressive. That's a load of shit. It totally is. So I understand that. Like, my friends and I were talking last night, and we were like, you know, we're almost 40, but our bodies are about 60. And, like, how do you navigate that? And that can be really hard, which leads me to the first big thing I want to talk about, because you've really championed this for me, and I appreciate it. I started using the term severely disabled recently, and people in the disability community didn't love it so much. And I am so curious why, but I'd love to talk about it for you in terms of like your experience. How does it feel using that terminology for yourself, and why do you do it?
I use the term severely disabled because I'm faced with with my reality of my disabled life every single day. I know how much I need help with, even if I don't like it. Being a wheelchair user, power wheelchair user, who needs help getting dressed every morning, using the restroom, so many of those care needs, I would classify that as being severely disabled.
Yeah.
As I would with so many other instances as well too. So I don't think, being a wheelchair user with all of those care needs, that's siloed into saying that's the only severely disabled look, right? There are so many severe disabilities that a person could have. And I think recognizing that with language is so important. We do want to be careful with what language we use. There are some bad disabled terms
Oh,
out
of
there.
course.
Here we know, but this one I just think it's so real that it's
Yeah.
so real to me that it's something I can grab onto and just accept. Even at my lowest point, at my highest point, I can say I'm severely disabled.
And I mean, it sends a message to people too, like we're here, we exist too. We're not going to be. And not to take anything away from these individuals, but we're not going to be like your spinal cord injury folks or your Paralympian folks. There's a di it's a different level, and it sets a different expectation than I think most people are used to when they think of disability.
Absolutely.
And I think that scares people. And I had somebody who kind of pushed back, and they were like, "Well, if you use severe, they're going to take all your rights away." And I was like, no, they're not. They're going to be forced to. I know, I see what you're saying, but if we use severe openly, they're going to be forced to look at it and put that in the language so that our policy changes.
I 100% agree. I think using that term so that others can understand, both disabled and non-disabled people, so they can understand, okay, if you're severely disabled, we should be doing everything in our power, no matter what institution you're at, right, to ensure that you have rights, that you have a place where you feel accepted. That's going to be the most important. And also that you have resources. That's one important thing that I forgot. The
Yeah.
resources available to severely disabled people are going to be so crucial for them to live out their life in the way that they want to.
Like the biggest resource I think for severely disabled folks like us is fucking attendant care and how just limiting it is, whether you're in with an agency or whether you're a self-manager, it is so non-existent. And the number of ads that I see on social media from fellow severely disabled folks who are like, "Hey, I need a worker for these and these hours," or, "Hey, I lost this person, couldn't come," or, "I'm stuck," and like, that's exhausting. It's that should never be where we are.
It's exhausting. I saw a reel on Instagram of a member of our community, and it was one of the reels that said, we're disabled or we're severely disabled. One of those should be, we're severely disabled. We make caregiver ads on our Instagrams, right? It's so common. And the attendant caregiver system in America and probably other places as well is broken. The pay is not high enough for care attendants. It is largely dependent on state by state. I
Yeah.
have friends in other states that do not have 24/7 care. They might only have 12 hours per week where there is an attendant with them, and that's not sustainable.
No, the rest either falls on family or your partner or.
That's life-threatening.
Yeah.
And, we need to be doing everything we can to ensure that disabled people, their family, and their friends are taken care of and have that social safety net where you can have clinical care hours, as much as you need to survive and live an independent life. That should just be a bottom line anywhere where you're at.
And one of the things you said kind of made me think of a second ago. You were like, the system is broken. And I almost said yes. But then I thought about it for a minute when you were talking. And I was like, the scary thing is, it's not broken. It is working exactly like they intended it to.
That's true.
It is not broken. It is going on exactly like they wanted it to. They didn't want it to be working good, because then they'd have to give up their precious dollars to show that disabled people have autonomy. Like, so no, I unfortunately I don't think it's broken at all, and that's terrifying.
I agree with you, and there are so many other instances as well where there are literal poverty traps for disabled people. Social Security is a system not designed for disabled people to survive and to be taken care of. There are, and I was actually speaking with this, it was interesting, in my graduate program, there's another student who actually worked in Social Security and has a lot of that policy experience from the institution side. And, we were talking together, me being on the recipient side, and we were so aligned on where we think the program should be, or is, and where it should be, right? So there's legislation happening right now that's in the works to increase what we call asset limits. And when people, think of that term, they're like, okay, it's just whatever's in my bank account. Well, no, it's how much does your car cost? Do you have a phone on you? How much cash is in your wallet right now? All of these things that with a very low threshold of only about $2,000 if you're single, $3,000 if you're married, which I don't even, the math is not mathing there.
Yeah, it really doesn't math there. And also, like, if you're married, aren't you still reliant on the other person to make up the bulk of your?
Absolutely. And it's not just then your income is in danger, is in jeopardy. It's also your health care, because commonly Social Security and Medicare are linked.
Yeah.
So it's really just a trap. I don't have a better word for it, but it's a trap for so many disabled people in the country. And, maybe it doesn't need to be fixed. Maybe we just need a new system. Social Security in itself is almost 100 years old.
Yeah, we need a new system. And they designed it to be a trap, my friends. They designed it to be a trap. That's what I feel like. I just feel like it was designed that way. Because, 100 years ago, when Social Security and those systems were enacted, disabled people didn't live super long. So let's give them some money and then they'll die and it's not a problem anymore. Like, and then it doesn't matter anymore. And now with advances in medicine, they're like, oh, fuck, what do we do?
Yeah, very ironically, that Social Security was a part of the kind of New Deal era by FDR, who was disabled.
Yeah.
Now it's not working for disabled people.
No, it's working against us entirely. Wow. One of the things you said a minute ago that I also wanted to touch on, you said, being severely disabled, you have to receive all the care, you need help with everything 24/7. And I want to talk about a little bit about what that feels like, because I don't think people who don't receive care like we do know the mental math we have to do to be okay with someone helping us 24/7, the exhaustion you have to be with someone helping you 24/7, and the kindness politics we have to play when somebody's in our home that, yeah, we respect them and they're nice and we're friendly, but you're also like, I want you to like go away so I can have alone time.
The movie Crip Camp, very famous documentary that I'm sure many members of our community and hopefully
don't worry, everyone that listening to the show has no has
yes had, I've never knows. Heard of Crip Camp before. No, so there's a great activist in there, Stevie Hoffman, who speaks about kind of the right to be alone and that right to privacy, and it rings true to this day. I am in the process of training a new caregiver, onboarding a new caregiver, and it's uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
I think when I have had, my mom or my dad care for me, they genuinely and generally know, okay, how I need to be positioned, all these things. So what happens when you train someone new is that you need to start voicing all of the things that you need assistance with.
Yeah.
And that can add up very
Oh, it's
quickly,
it.
very quickly in your mind.
Yeah, I agree with you. It can take its toll, and like the amount of times I have to say, "Now I want this. Now I want this." What about the, like most of my caregivers know now, but initially, when you onboard a new person, it's you're by the end of an hour with them, you're like, "Okay, I'm exhausted now. I don't do anything. I don't do anything for the rest of the day."
Exactly. And for me, if I get set up with my laptop and I'm on, an amazing podcast like this, luckily I'm having alone time right now, so this is wonderful. But it takes a toll, because you start to realize again, it's almost like you forget. You don't forget how much you need help with, but voicing it is such an elevated step, right?
Yeah.
Of saying, wow, I do need help with a lot. And it brings back that internalized ableism for me. And it just hits me like a train.
Yo, it's really hard. The internalized ableism is something I'm struggling with it today. I'm like, yep, no one likes me. I'll be alone forever. And that, and it's, which is a silly thing to think, but the internalized ableism is so prevalent, and it's something we don't talk about, and I think severely disabled folks experience it differently because we need so much help.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, when we speak about internalized ableism, one thing that you just said, you realize you know that that's wrong, that that's false, right?
Yeah.
But it's still in your head and it doesn't go away.
No.
It's just trying to figure out ways to manage it that are healthy is something that I think a lot of people grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think, and I, well, because most people don't know what it is. When you say, well, when we say ableism, most people don't know what we're talking about. When you say internalized ableism, they really don't know what you're talking about. Like, what is that? What? Oh, I didn't know you dealt with that. How is, like, how do you manage that? And so I want to ask you, how do you manage the voices that tell you the things that are not true?
That's a great question. What I try to do is practice what I call radical independence. And I think for a lot of severely disabled folks, we might not get to experience that often or even a little bit. What I mean by radical independence is I will make an adventure in my head. I saw a tweet from you. It says being disabled is kind of like an adventure map every day. You don't re really know what's gonna happen, right? But
Yeah.
it's what you do. So I plan out adventures in my head that I try to do on my own. It's gonna be scary at first, but it's what I need to practice that radical independence. And an example of that is going to the city, San Francisco. So I'm in Berkeley right now in grad school, and going to San Francisco can be a trek. But luckily, God bless public transportation, the San Francisco Bay Ferry leaves out of Oakland and is about a 25-minute ferry ride from Oakland to San Francisco. I can have my attendant drive me to Oakland. I can get on the ferry on my own. They have a very accessible app that you can purchase tickets on.
Yeah.
They can have half price for disabled people. So San Francisco Bay Ferry loves disabled people. And
They're pretty great. I remember taking, I don't know if I took the ferry, but I took some boat when I was there, and they're very nice.
very nice. And you have your own space to sit in. I just love it. So you take the ferry over, and boom, you're there in San Francisco in front of the ferry building on Embarcadero. And I just ride my wheelchair up and down Embarcadero. I went as far up as Ghirardelli Square. I've gone as far down as Oracle Park, where the San Francisco Giants play. And
Amazing.
being able to experience that, it's just like you're on an e-bike.
Yeah.
It's and you just listen to music, and it clears my head, and it makes me realize that I'm, you know, this radical independence saves me sometimes. It's scary, but it's worth it in the end for me.
Now, when I hear radical independence, I don't know what that means, because I talk about it kind of differently. I talk about how I'm not necessarily independent, and I talk about how I'm dependent or interdependent, and that's okay. So what does radical independence mean to you? Can you like define that for me?
Radical independence to me is a reminder that even though I may be severely disabled, I can still experience the joy, the adventure, and the excitement that anyone else can, but not so more in the inspiration realm, because that's another dangerous area to land in. It just makes me love my disabled self even more, because I can do these things while being disabled, because it's even more difficult to get on the ferry, right? I have to watch where I'm going. I have to make sure I don't fall off the boat, right? And that adventure, just completing that, I feel like it resets a majority of my internalized ableism. Now, I know internalized ableism can get broken up into several different areas, right? You have your academic, you have your personal life,
Oh
you have
yeah,
your
of course.
romantic life. This is something that I can hold on to just for me, and it'll make me feel secure within myself.
I think that's awesome, and I think we need to cultivate more disabled joy. And to that point, other than like walking around and going on ferries and hopefully not falling off boats, what about disability would you say, or your disability experience, brings you joy?
I just love the community. The community brings me the most joy. I remember when we were at Davis, when I was attending there for undergrad, we didn't have a disability community circa 2020 in the middle of the pandemic. We had to create that there.
Wow.
The advocacy committee organization for our undergraduate association, it was called the Disability Rights and Advocacy Committee, that we changed to the Disability Justice Committee.
Thank you.
When I,
Amazing. So
of
good.
course, when I transferred to UC Davis in 2020, that committee didn't have a budget. That committee didn't have any members. And that was something I said we need to change, because that is the only formal body within the association that advocates for students with disabilities. So that was step number one, is let's change that. And once we did that, we started organizing around our community groups. Our disabled student union launched in 2021. We had a very big Aggie neurodiversity community that was also a part of our community. And we created a coalition called Disability Davis that was all three of our student organizations and the Student Disability Center at UC Davis, all focused in aligning our goals to serving this community. And we were able to hold welcome events, where we were able to have speakers just like you. And it all culminated into having this huge celebration in the spring of 2023, where we had the first disability commencement ceremony at UC Davis.
Amazing.
We had over 35 graduating seniors with disabilities, about 100 family members, and it was the most beautiful community event that I think I've ever been a part of. So the community brings me disabled joy, and just the programming and everything that goes into the support that we can offer young adults with disabilities is, there's nothing better than that.
And I think, having a disabled commencement ceremony specifically designed around disability, when the fuck has that ever happened? Like, that's.
I was inspired by UC Berkeley. So Berkeley, I think, does a lot for the disability community in terms of the resources that they have on campus, different programs that you can be a part of. And they also have a disability culture and community center here. And it's
Yeah.
the first one in the entire University of California system. And they did a CRIP commencement the year before we did at Davis. And they had Judy Heumann come. They had just amazing leaders from the disability community.
Yeah.
And that was so important so that our students could be recognized, because it's not a guarantee that you'll graduate. Just like how you said, Social Security, the system wasn't meant to work. The system of academia is not meant to work for
Yeah.
disabled. So having this so that they can recognize that they've overcome, the hardships of faculty not granting your legally obligated accommodations and
Isn't that fucking bullshit? Like
so.
that
So many other awful ableist experiences that I know our students live with and carry on with them. Having that celebration for them is just the least that we could do to recognize that.
Now we went all over the place, and I know that you hold positions in student government and all those things, and so I kind of asked you all those questions backwards. Tell me about your position, and then it will illuminate all the things you just said.
Yeah, I got started in student activism pretty much right when I transferred to UC Davis and noticed that gap for students with disabilities, not just in the community, but also with the programming that the university was offering and the support that we were getting during the pandemic. I ended up running for Student Senate at UC Davis. The Associate Students of UC Davis, and got elected with an amazing group of student leaders that were rooted in transformative change and justice, right, for so many different student communities at Davis. And, we worked on a multitude of different things, all intertwined in that theme. We had power outages at UC Davis. During that winter, that affected nearly 3,000 students who actually were living on campus during the pandemic, still, mainly in that transfer and reentry housing that had just opened up. But there were also things that we advocated for on the academic side, that had to do with online proctored exams and how facial recognition and that AI discriminated against people with darker skin tones. And even me having a physical disability, there was a checklist of things that you needed to go through before you were able to take the exam, one of which is not having anyone in your room. The other is lifting up your laptop to check out your workspace to make sure you're not having notes and whatnot. Now, that was a one or the other for me in that situation, because am I going to be without a caregiver for a number of hours where I might drop my phone, I might drop my laptop, who knows? But if that person is gone, I can't lift up my laptop and show you anything. I'm just not strong enough,
Yeah.
right? So it was that experience that I shared with our administrators, and I think they understood just how bad it was, and we were able to make some changes and work with our academic senate to not use that.
I mean, it's just when you put it in pl as plainly as you just did, like, it's so silly what you're asking for and how, like, you're not saying that if you don't. If you, I'm gonna cheat. You're saying I just need accommodation so that I can use my, like.
And at a public institution, I didn't expect for it to be that hard.
Yeah, exactly.
To have policies in place that were free of ableism and racism and sexism and all of these things, I just, it was new, so new that it would be not just something we would push for, it would be a fight to get.
Yeah.
So that kind of prompted my entrance into student activism and just being of service for students and really for all community members in the Davis area. I ended up running for student body president at Davis when peers that I deeply respect came to me and said, hey, Ryan, we think you'd be a great candidate to run for president. And my jaw hit the floor because I said I had that imposter syndrome coupled with internalized ableism. Said,
That's what we call a Gimposter syndrome, just in case.
I'm a transfer student. I just got here 6 months ago. How can I even possibly accurately represent over 30,000 students? But they believed in me and kind of the vision that I had to serve students when we moved back into person. But also when we were moving back into person from the pandemic, being so active in those administrative meetings where they were discussing, okay, should we roll back our COVID-19 testing? Should we make it like a 4-day thing and not every single, day, 7 days a week for testing? Having a severely disabled voice in that room with some of the top administrators of the university was something that I knew I could be of service for
Oh,
our
this is
students.
so necessary. I mean, can we also have you in the room for like when the CDC tells us like, oh, only the severely disabled people are gonna die? That's all right, right? That's
It's
cool.
it is too common where we don't have disabled voices in the room that policies that are inherently ableist get implemented. And to us, it's simple. The fix is simple. Just include disabled people because our insights, our experiences are so necessary for how the, 20, 25% of the country will be affected by a particular policy. So it's
And
simple to us. I wish it was simple to others.
with COVID being a mass disabling event that's happening still right now in the world, like when I did the episode with the podcast with the Try Guys a couple of years ago, they put a stat up that was like, it's 1.1 million people are going to become mass disabled. That's probably tripled by now. That's a terrifying stat to think of, and to think that if 3.1 million people are going to become disabled as a result of COVID, why are we not ensuring our policies are not ableist? Like, what?
It brings me back to something that you said when we spoke a number of years ago, is when, if you're, everyone will become disabled at some point in their lives. And if you're already disabled, you're going to be become more disabled. And it goes back to that. This will affect everyone. And we need to make sure that all of our systems work for everyone.
And the outset of the outside of that is if you don't become disabled, if you're somehow lucky enough to not win that lottery, you will know somebody who is disabled in your life. And like this makes me, when I think about housing and like just the way we sell houses to people in the world, some of them have like big stairs and all this stuff, and especially where you are in the Bay Area, like they are not accessible. And I think, what if somebody that I was hanging out with, a guy that I wanted to see, a date that I wanted to go on, was like, oh yeah, I want to come to my house? Oh wait, you can't because I have no ramp. But if we made every house everywhere accessible, regardless of your ability level, you could say, you know what, my friend with a disability can come to my house.
That is the first question that I always have to ask my friends. And I want to make sure that I can do everything in my power now and later in life to ensure that we have accessible spaces. I saw a statistic that I think only 4% of US homes are fully accessible. It might be more, might be less, but I mean, it's definitely below 20%. There's so much that we need to do. And what's that saying to older disabled people when they want to become homeowners? It says you're gonna have to do all of this work just to become a homeowner. And obviously, I mean, that's going to be blown in California no matter what, but still you
Oh
it's
no.
not realistic.
Didn't you know, Ryan? You're not becoming a homeowner. They're putting you in an institution. Like, don't you know,
Yeah.
like that's where we're at it. Like, hate to break it to you, but that's where
Yeah.
you're being warehoused.
My goodness. I know there was a lot of pushback. I don't know if we want to get into it here, but there was a lot of pushback on Prop 1 in California that had to do with institutionalization for severely disabled people. And it's bring up a lot of problems for our community. And I think there's organizations like Disability Rights California that are doing some work to combat that. But still, it's a red flag when you see policies like that. They're supposed to be new, they're supposed to be revolutionary, but have these detrimental effects for a large number of people.
Can you talk to Disability Rights California and say, like, hey, can you change your name to Disability Justice California, please? I don't know if you know anybody over there, but if anybody from Disability Rights California is listening, like, you do great stuff. I'm from there, was born in Cali, raised in Toronto, but born in Orange County. So you do great stuff over there, but maybe be more inclusive? I don't know.
I'll drop that recommendation.
Yeah, just say Andrew Gerza says that you should. One of the things that you wanted to talk about today, and I think is so important, is you feel there's, you mentioned in the questionnaire that you feel there's a lack of disabled progressive leadership. And I would love to kind of understand your thoughts on that and how, like, how do we find disabled leaders that are going to make change?
You know, the last, I think mentorship, I want to start with mentorship. Mentorship and having disabled role models is so important for young disabled people to see that they can live, right? Things, even as dark as they might seem in some places and in some situations in life, you can get a college education, you can start your own business, you can be a singer-songwriter, you can be a TikTok influencer, all of these different things, right, that I've seen many, many people do in our community. But when we talk about political leadership among our disabled community, there have not been a whole lot of wonderful disabled leaders out there. When I
No.
think of disabled people in politics and the most forward-facing people who work within the system, I see people like Madison Cawthorn.
I was just gonna say, I was like, oh no, that's
I see people like Greg Abbott, and those people do not accurately represent the needs of our community.
no.
And what's the needs of our community? Okay, having a well-funded social safety net to where Medicare and healthcare is available for everyone, no matter what the cost is. It should be the responsibility of the government, of the state, to take care of its citizens by having healthcare available widely to its most vulnerable populations. And when we see politicians stripping that away, that immediately contradicts who we're serving. Now, what I will say is that there's been other wonderful disabled leaders. Tammy Duckworth, for instance, in the US Senate out of Illinois, doing wonderful work to ensure that aircrafts and air transportation is more accessible for disabled people. It's happening a little slower than we might want it to, but it's happening nonetheless. And I think we can get to a place in, 5, 10, 15 years where we can bring our wheelchairs onto the airplane the same way we do with our private transportation if we have an accessible ride or in any bus or ferry system,
You're
right?
so political, so I'll be the other side. You're so like polished there. I'll be the other side. Yeah, you're right. It's happening, but fuck, could it go a little bit faster? I want to fly 10, 15 years. I want to fly now.
We
And so,
need.
like, I hear you, and you're right. And you're so like, you know how you're gonna be one of those forward-facing leaders that you were talking about. I can see it in like 10, 20 years. I can see you in the Senate somewhere. For somebody, so I can see it already. But as the lay person with a disability, I'm gonna come back and say, yeah, it's happening. But like, it's gotta happen faster. And to Madison Cawthorn, like, dude, can you just go away? I don't understand why you make all of us look horrible. Go away.
It's just, I hope widely that people know that, he is not an accurate depiction of what our disabled
No.
experience is like.
He will be funded by the NRA the rest of his existence. He'll be just fine. He'll be just fine because the NRA will prop him up. But he is full of privilege, is completely misinformed on what disability justice looks like, and It's a really bad role model. So, kids, if you ever looked at him and thought, look, there's a disabled guy there, we don't own, we don't, we were not, we don't claim him. No, thank you. So we talked a little bit about disability joy a minute ago, and thank you for talking so much about disability politics in the academic system, because no one understands what that's like, and no one understands how hard it is to get the things you need. But so I want to talk about, we talked about joy a minute ago. I want to talk about the flip side of that. What brings you disability grief?
What brings me disability grief is being the only one in the room that looks like me. And I feel like I've been in a position over the years where we're saying, oh, yeah, Ryan, representation, right? But if I'm the only one speaking on disability issues in these spaces, we need more. We need more of us
Yeah.
in order to collectively work through the things that we need together, right? Advocacy and activism cannot fall on one person. We need to include as many bodies, as many minds as possible, especially when we're considering and talking about the disability community. So
Yeah.
that's one thing that brings me disability grief, is when I'm the only person in the room that looks like.
Can I offer you a way to reframe that for yourself so it brings you a little bit less grief?
Yeah.
You being the only disabled person in the room is a powerful statement. It is, yeah, and it brings me grief too. And trust me, I know when I'm, and you are in like the gayest town in the world. And I believe me, I can only dream, I'm going off on a tangent here, but whatever. I can only dream of going to like the hottest gay bar in San Francisco and being the biggest slut in the world. But I can't do that because I can't get in. And if I could get in, I'd probably be the only disabled person in the room. My point is that I have often been the only disabled person in the room to doing something, doing being representation. And yeah, I've also felt like you felt like, oh, this is really hard. And like I look around and I don't see myself. But then at the same time, I look around and I go, thank God they can see me. Thank goodness they can see me. Because if they couldn't, then what are we even doing? But at least I'm in the room and I can use just by being there. And I've been in some pretty famous fucking rooms. And it's like, not to toot my own horn, but I went to a big New York party a couple years ago and I was the only wheelchair person in the room. I went to a big LA party a couple years ago and I was the only wheelchair user in the room. And it was, you look at that moment and you go, that's really upsetting. It pisses me off. And I wish there was someone else like me. But you look at that moment also and you go, like, I am the only wheelchair user on the red carpet right now, or I'm the only wheelchair user in this university senate room. And thank God for me, because if I wasn't here, what would they not be doing?
That makes me feel better, Andrew.
I'm so glad I could do that. So I hope that like quells your grief just a little bit, because I know I understand that feeling, being the only, the loneliness of being the only one that needs help. And like that, I feel that way too around being severely disabled, being like, I'm the only one that needs help with my drink. I'm the only one that needs to be fed. I'm the only one that needs to, help in the bathroom. And it can be really hard to be in the room and need that. But when they look at you and they see that you're there, all those non-disabled folks or folks with different level of ability, they're gonna look at that and go, thank goodness he's in the room. Maybe not, but you can look at them and think, thank goodness I'm here.
That's powerful. No, that's what I love about just, oh my goodness, Andrew, breaking down internalized ableism barriers after barrier. I tell you, that's why I love just speaking with members of our community, is that you can completely get something reframed, reworked in your mind that you were down on, that you had grief on, working through these things, speaking with people who have similar experiences to you, is how we can create a more succinct and healthier community.
Yeah, and I think, when people say, I'm the only one here, Of course, grieve that and be sad about it. Take a day and tell everybody to fuck right off about it, of course. And you should do that. And that's healthy and normal and okay. But also, when you're really sad about it, like, reframe it not for anybody else, but for you. I am the only one in the room, and you better fucking shine a spotlight on me because I deserve it.
And I'll listen to some Hamilton in the room where it happens while I do that.
Yeah, ex there you go. Exactly. In my case, I would listen to, like, well, I'd probably listen to some Kelly Clarkson bops and hang it. But, like, you know, I'm a musical theater kid, but I'm more like the Phantom. I'm more like, you know, the old school. Yeah. I could sit and chat with you all day. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you want to touch on?
I one thing that I just want to echo is the importance of community. And I know I said that a little bit earlier, but the importance of community, finding people that you can identify with and share experiences with of how to just live are so valuable. I know I also spoke about mentorship, but I think mentoring the youth is so important to me. And we can all do it with whatever area expertise that we have. But for me, I love assisting young people with SMA who are looking at college. What route to go? Should they stay in state? Should they go out of state? Was community college an option? Or they want to go straight to a 4-year? All of, and then grad school too. All of these things, just supporting them because I know I didn't have that. So
Yeah.
I want to be there for them so they have someone to ask these questions to that have lived those experiences right within 5 years. And I remember I took a group of teens with SMA to do a tour at Davis, and we were just rolling the campus. Sometimes I use non-disabled language, and sometimes we were rolling the campus, and I was just showing them, okay, here's the most accessible way to get from point A to point B. And oh, be careful of that pothole, or don't go this way because it's really rough on your wheelchair. And just being able to answer those questions for them and kind of just guide them in that direction is something that is so special to me, that I can offer, right, to the next generation of disabled people. So I
Like,
would say, go ahead. Sorry.
no, you go ahead. Go ahead.
I would just say to people, try to find that community and where you can be of service for the people who will come after you. That's
Yeah.
one thing. That's one thing that's brought me disabled joy.
Oh, I love it. What do you want to do after grad school? Like, what's your plan?
I want to be in the position where I can still be doing the things I'm doing here. Being of service to others is where I'm always the most complete, the most whole. It's a remarkable experience and position to be in where you can articulate just how bad or just how good the community is doing. Take that from the disability community, take that from the graduate community and student activism. But sharing those experiences and the experiences of others is what I want to do in my future. So that's very vague. I'm leaving it open-ended on purpose.
President,
We did it, Ryan. No, so I'm just going to leave it at that. However I can be of service to people who need it, I'm more than willing to do.
in Congress somewhere. I mean, I'm seeing it. I listen, I don't know. I just think seeing a severely disabled person in Congress would be a game changer. So seriously, vote for Ryan Manriquez 2035. I don't know what year that would be, but 2035, 10 years from now, yeah. This was so fun. Thank you for hopping on and having a chat. It was a good time. How do the people, if they want to follow you, Ryan, how do they do that?
Feel free to follow my Instagram, Ryan Manriquez with 2 Z's at the end. That's the best way to keep in touch. Shoot me a DM, and we can stay connected on there. Anyone who needs advice about higher education or just being disabled and trying to make it, I'm more than willing to talk with you. And yeah, I do hope that you reach out.
Please do, because I mean, there's so many students out there right now who need guidance and who want just a friend and who like, how the fuck do I do this? And so you be the perfect person to do that. Ryan Manriquez, this was such a pleasure. Thank you for coming on Disability After Dark.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Anytime. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Bye.
Bye. All right, friends. Well, there goes another episode of Disability After Dark, the podcast shining a bright light on disability stories with me, your host, Andrew Gerza. If you want to follow my work, you can head over to my social media, Andrew Gerza6 on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, although I never use it. If you want to follow my website and find out about my speaking opportunities, my gigs, and ways to have me come to your event, go to www.andrewgerza.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can go to patreon.com/disabilityafterdark, and you can get the show days early, completely ad-free, and a shout-out on the air. So if you want to support the show, you're able to do that. And please, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help shows like this about disability, which are very rare, get supported. Thank you so much for being with us, and stay comfy, cozy, and crippled. Until next time. Bye. Copyright notice. Disability After Dark was created, recorded, and produced by Cripple & Co. Productions and Andrew Gerza. Any and all use of materials, graphics, audio recordings, etc., cannot be used or distributed without express permission. If you would like to use an episode of the podcast or license an episode of the podcast on your website, please consider emailing Andrew Gerza and Cripple & Co. Productions at disabilityafterdarkpod@gmail.com. Copyright 2024.